Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 13th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept and co-host of Counterpoints on this casual but spooky Friday the 13th. Meanwhile, Attorney General Merrick Garland has appointed a special counsel to investigate the classified documents that Biden's team discovered and disclosed. I should add.
Same as me. Kind of.
The exact same. The House quietly passed a bill before Republicans took over that increased House member compensation, a tiny bit less leverage for moneyed interests to come in and corrupt them. The deficit has fallen from $2.7 trillion a year earlier to $1.4 trillion in 2022. But don't tell that to Republicans who are already promising to shut down the government over the debt ceiling in a few months, or in months. The White House is unrolling a program to help Afghan parolees living in the U.S. reunite with their family members, which is good. At least seven have died due to extreme storms in the South. Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi hit hard. Tens of thousands without power. Kenan Anderson, a father, an English teacher, and cousin of one of the Black Lives Matter co-founders, has died of cardiac arrest after being tased repeatedly by the LAPD. A new study published in the journal Science confirms that internal Exxon scientists were raising the alarm about global warming since the 1970s, even as the company publicly denied its culpability for decades and smeared scientists who were saying the same thing.
I remember being scolded over using the "What Exxon Knew" hashtag.
Honestly, yeah, that was the Exxon report was like, I think at the beginning of it was when the Al Gore documentary came out, same time, I think. The U.S. is poised to send high-tech tanks to Ukraine in expectation of another Russian offensive. This, plus the sharing of Patriot air defense systems last month, is seen as a bit of a break from previous norms about sharing this kind of weaponry. Dozens of congressional Democrats have sent Biden a letter urging him to expel Jair Bolsonaro from the U.S. after his supporters stormed Brazil's government buildings based on right-wing election lies. Venezuela might be buckling under the pressure of crushing U.S. sanctions. Their government is reportedly back in talks with ConocoPhillips, I could never say it, to sell oil to the U.S. And lastly, South Korea is threatening to build nuclear weapons. The first time this threat has been made in decades, and wrong direction, denuclearization is what we need. All this and more on today's Majority Report. You might be surprised to see me. You might be surprised to hear me reading the headlines. And usually if I'm hosting by myself, I'll say in for Sam Cedar. I omitted that because we are joined by Sam Cedar from his home.
Yes, I am.
Did you get a kick out of the headlines?
That was quite an experience. I've never, ever been on the show with anybody, Matt, Michael, anyone ever. Doing the headlines, so that was very fun for me. It's Conoco,
Yeah.
Conoco.
Conoco Phillips. Oh, you're correct. You know,
it's so much easier to be sitting here from the side and just saying, like, you mispronounced that.
You're like an IMer into the program.
So easy.
But this is what we call a soft coup, right? I mean, it's slowly I just take your powers away from you, so you become some sort of like figurehead, like
ceremonial.
Yeah. That's going to just start edging me out of frame, and yeah. I'm just going to slide. I should just say, my daughter has COVID, and obviously I've been exposed to my daughter, although. I guess because she's a teenager, and anybody who has a teenager knows not that much. She really has very little to do with me that doesn't involve, you know, like sending her money on Venmo, essentially. And we don't even see each other for that. So, but out of a, and I've been testing negative. We were both exposed simultaneously, like 6 days ago on Saturday, actually. She was far more exposed than I was to these folks who ended up having COVID. And it took her until yesterday morning to test positive. And so just out of an abundance of caution, I'm not in the office today because I didn't want to get everybody else to have COVID. Then it would be just a crap show. And but adding to that, we should say I don't know how long I'm going to last, because literally I can touch, I'm now touching the wall on the other side, 6 inches on the other side of that wall. They are doing demolition to somebody's kitchen, I think it is, or something. I have no idea what's going on over there, but it's loud. And of course, on the other side of my apartment, by the windows, there's like there's a water main thing, and there's jackhammers and cars honking. So that's that. We'll see. We'll try and get through the first half. I should say that I'm not out with COVID today, but a new report shows that basically the number of people who are missing work because of illness has shot up by almost 50%. From 2020 through that last year, nearly 1.5 million people missing work each month. And back in 2018, there were almost 10 months where it was less than a million people. In 2017, there were 7 months under a million. You know, when you get in the flu season, it pops up a little bit, but we have a significantly just half a million more, 50% more people, more or less, missing work on at any given month because of illness. And so, but yet we're led to believe COVID not real. And yeah. And of course, that's where people are getting a lucky break, and they're not subjected to, and they can afford to miss work, or in many instances they can't. And so that's just, I don't know, that struck me. It came out today and at being at home. But let's play this clip of Kevin McCarthy. This is his first press conference, and it did not go well. I imagine that we will see more supplication by the press going forward. But in this instance, it was just seemed to be low-hanging fruit. Kevin McCarthy making a, just, I don't know, blatantly lying. I don't know how important it is. We'll talk to Ryan Grimm about it, but here's Kevin McCarthy blatantly lying, and some reporter had the audacity to mention it. I don't care too much about Swalwell or Adam Schiff, but the reporter fails to also mention Ilhan Omar. But here it is.
No, because mine wasn't ignoring a subpoena. I said I would gladly go if we got to appoint people to the committee. If it was not political, you will find the fundamental difference of me being
pause it. We should also mention they're talking about the January 6th committee. They have members who avoided a subpoena. The reason why there was no Republicans on the January 6th committee was because, A, they started out by ignoring it. They refused. Remember, the first one was to be a select committee where there would be six Democrats mm-hmm. and six Republicans. Maybe it was 9-9, but I think it was 6-6. They refused to do that. And by the time they came around to agreeing to it, the only person I think they wanted to put on there was like what's-his-face who just left. Not Virgil Good, but Louis Gohmert, I think they wanted to put on. And people who were, you know, fundamentally trying to block the committee, they didn't like that. And so here he is complaining about it.
Ignoring a subpoena, I said I would gladly go if we got to appoint people to the committee. If it was not political, you will find the fundamental difference of me being a speaker and Nancy Pelosi. The other side will get to name their members on the committee. It won't be handpicked by me and denying the Democrats their voice. So whatever transpires out of that committee is work to Republicans and Democrats as we move forward. It's a fundamental difference. Why?
You said you're going to let Democrats appoint their own members to the committee, but you've also indicated you're not going to let them.
I was very clear early on. Let me phrase something very direct to you.
If you got Can we just be clear? You go back because she asked, like, wait a second. You just said that you're not going to deny them seats on the committee, but you've done that with like Swalwell, and you've done that with Schiff, and she didn't mention Ilhan Omar, but those mm-hmm. are the three that at least that we know of. And it takes them a while to figure out, like, how am I going to answer this question? Go back. It's fun to watch this. McCarthy's brain sort of work.
That's a great statement. Let me state something really direct to you.
As opposed to the way I plan to answer your question.
Yeah. It won't be handpicked by me and denying the Democrats their voice. So whatever transpires out of that committee is work to Republicans and Democrats as we move forward. It's a fundamental difference.
Why? You said you're going to let Democrats appoint their own members.
I was very clear early on. Let me phrase something very direct to you. If you got the briefing I got from the FBI, you wouldn't have Swalwell on any committee. And you're going to tell me other Democrats couldn't fill that slot? He cannot get a security clearance in the private sector. So would you like to give him a government clearance? You asked me questions about Santos. You asked the questions about Swalwell. Not only was he getting a clearance, he was inside an intel committee.
Okay, what about Schiff?
He had more information than the majority of all the members. Did you ever raise that issue? No, which you should have. You're going to tell me there's 200 other Democrats that couldn't fill that slot, but they kept him on it? The only way that they even knew it came forward is when they went to nominate him to the Intel Committee. And then the FBI came and told the leadership then, he's got a problem.
He was clear.
And they kept him on. That jeopardized all of us. Adam Schiff openly lied to the American public. He told you he had proof. He told you he didn't know the whistleblower. He put America for 4 years through an impeachment that he knew was a lie.
Ooh,
at the same time we had Ukraine, at the same time we had Afghanistan collapse. Was that?
Yeah. All right. I mean, it just goes on now. And now he's run out of like sort of like extreme.
He was caught in a lie and just went then into bloviation mode.
Let me phrase something very direct to you.
Yeah. that phrasing was not direct in and of itself, but.
Let me just remind you, I've never answered a straight question to you ever.
Yeah.
I've never given you a straight answer to any of your questions in the past. But there it is. That's the first of Kevin McCarthy's thing. And I think it's definitely worth us playing that just so that we encourage reporters in the future to continue to ask questions like that. But we'll see. And we'll talk to Ryan Grimm about that a little bit, too, in a moment. Got a couple of sponsors today. As you know, I am very sensitive about getting my identity stolen. One of the ways I protect myself is Aura. I can actually get, I don't really have to. My mom's not using email so much. My parents, I was very, very explicit with like phishing and scam stuff. I'm like, there's no, never, ever, I don't care who you get an email from, ever click on a link. Oh, don't ever, ever do it. I don't care what it is. Don't ever click on a link.
My grandparents thought they had to bail me out of jail one time for $10,000, and they figured out like, oh yeah, actually Matt's just fine. He's sleeping in Brooklyn right now. But yeah.
Well, maybe that's more of a function of like what they expect out of you.
Right.
But that's not the point. I'm excited to partner with today's sponsor, Aura, because Aura has an easy-to-use app that includes everything you need to stay safe online. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers by scanning the so-called dark web. That's where, you know, criminals sell stolen information. It looks for your emails, it looks for your passwords, it looks for your social security numbers, and then it lets you know fast if it finds anything. And Aura helps you fight back against those annoying websites that put your personal information online by automatically requesting removal of that info. This helps reduce robocalls, helps with operational security. Aura also gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if somebody was opening a loan or a credit card in your name. I mean, really, any credit inquiries. In my experience, that let me know, which is I want that because it's I'm not you know. It's once in a blue moon that I'm getting credit inquiries. If you're going to rent an apartment or you're starting a bank account for your kid, like I did, they let me know. It makes me feel secure. They have a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and your personal information safe and encrypted. They protect your devices from viruses, malware, spyware, so bad guys can't break in. I don't know. Sometimes you hear stories of people getting their data held hostage. Aura can even help you manage what your kids can do on their devices. You can restrict specific apps. You can put time limits on their thing. You can set focus time so your kid does their homework, not watching funny videos and what would happen if, like, if some karate expert didn't know what he was doing and it's about his nunchucks banging him on the head, which is what Saul's favorite videos are. They also have a passwords manager that lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. And you might have an app that does one of these things. This does it all. Let Aura do the hard work of keeping you safe online. If you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you 2 weeks free with a free trial with my link. You're going to be shocked at how much your private information Aura might find exposed over those 2 weeks. Go to aura.com/majority. Start your free trial. It will also be linked below in the podcast and YouTube and descriptions as well in the website. Also, one of our sponsors today, Blinkist. It's a service I've been using for years. It is an app that basically takes, I guess they have like over 5,000 nonfiction books and puts them into, you know, what we used to call Cliff Notes, where they give you the top takeaways of those in about 15 minutes, sometimes a little bit longer, sometimes a little bit shorter, either in audio or written form, and which they call blinks when it's written, shortcasts when it's audio. They have all sorts of books in there, and they also have a feature which I was looking at the other day, which recommends like collections to you. Let me read off some of the ones that they have for me. And it's probably because of what I've fished around, but one was Be More Charismatic in 10 Days. one was How to Be Liked. And then there's like one where This is the Universe, which, you know, gives you essentially like, a couple of these books, blinks or audio shortcasts on understanding like physics. I don't know how the charismatic thing happened, but it happens. But also you can find books like Shutdown. We interviewed Adam Tooze about that and get the key takeaways. Edward Bernays' Propaganda. I mean, across the board, they have a wide range of nonfiction titles.
Also, as somebody who read that book, that Tooze book, it might be good just to refresh myself on the sort of skeleton of it, because it's a big, expansive book.
It works both ways too, because not only is it a good way to refresh your memory about a book that you've read? It also is a way to say like, oh, you know what? I think I might go read this whole book. It might be worth it. It's a great It's a great product. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. Start your 7-day free trial. Get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership. And we should say, through the Blinkist premium membership, you can get Blinkist Connect, which is essentially 2-for-1. You can share with either a family member or a friend, and it's basically 2-for-1. So check that out. It really is, it's nuts. You can share everything that you blink, as it were. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report. Get 25% off in a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/majority report. And now for a limited time, you can use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You will get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1, like I say. Also, favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is Best gets you 20% off. They are all of their products. They've got a wide array of stuff. They've got gummies, some that has THC and CBD, but in, like, so tiny a THC that it's legal. But for, you know, folks like I who are a little bit out of practice, you feel it. But also they have CBD with melatonin. I just had my sleep consultation with a doctor. I did that whole sleep thing. They said to me, melatonin, I have slight sleep apnea too. Apparently that's another issue, but melatonin, very helpful. But they also have tinctures, which helps me get to sleep. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls and kief in that and flower. And they have the only product I think I've ever put on my body that wasn't in the shower. Like, I use soap in the shower. But a skin lotion. What do you call it? Moisturizing lotion?
Yeah.
A moisturizing lotion, which is unscented, but has CBD in it. Oh, and also
there's a scented one that smells amazing for people that like scented things. Not Sam, but others.
Yeah, I won't do that. But it also, I'll tell you, it really, I get some very dry skin, and that was incredibly helpful. I also, I guess I put the Arnica CBD balm on my eczema at times, but all sorts of great products. They're great. They have great business practices, $20 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They have great farming practices, regenerative farming. They use integrated pest management, so no pesticides. Check them out, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Great company, and they're fans of the show. So Left is Best will get you 20% off. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm will be joining us. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept and co-host on Counterpoints. We'll be right back after this.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report, and I have figured out that I had my computer mic on for the first 10 minutes of the show. And so we have fixed that. Thank you to the IMers who
still
let
not
us know
as good
that.
As, still not as good as Ryan Grimm's mic, though.
Yeah, great mic.
Well, it turns out my Ryan's mic is a little bit better, but I want to welcome him to the show. Nevertheless, Ryan Grimm, he is the bureau chief, the Washington Bureau of The Intercept, and also co-host of Counterpoints.
That's right.
Ryan.
It was Counterpoints Friday. Now it's Counterpoints Wednesday.
Oh, did you switch it to Wednesday now?
Switch it to Wednesday. Yeah.
Whoa, there's a lot of stuff going on with that show. Yep. That is huge. And yet, you dressed up for this today.
I did. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm impressed.
Planning on leaving the house today.
It's called Casual Friday, though, Ryan. That's the issue.
No tie.
Well, that's in the spirit.
So, all right. So, Ryan, let's dig into this. We have a new Congress. We just played a clip earlier of Kevin McCarthy's first press conference where he made the really vociferous point. There's a difference between me and Nancy Pelosi. I'm not keeping any Democrats off the committees. And then he had to answer a question as to why he was keeping certain Democrats off the committees. And he seemed to get a little testy about that. But nevertheless, give us a sense of like what we know. His concessions were. And what the implications are going to be about that. I know you wrote about one of the most important one, which is the debt ceiling, which really is, at the end of the day, probably the most important one. But talk about it broadly and then dig down into that.
But here's the question, though. Is it actually a concession? You know, in 2011 and 2013, Republicans, you know, back when they were the party of Mitt Romney, you know, waged a relentless campaign around the debt ceiling in order to extract concessions from Democrats. And in fact, that's what gave them the sequester. That's what got them the, you know, significant parts of the Bush tax cuts made permanent. And the sequester, if people remember, really slowed down the recovery for years. If you look at the charts, you know, the stimulus was too small.
Will you remind people what the sequester was? Because it was and I remember at the time there were people who thought like, oh, this is a great idea because the Republicans will never go along with it because it cuts, defense spending, but it capped all spending. And so it prevented the government from essentially pouring money into the economy, which it needed to do to make sure that it was, in the wake of the financial crisis.
Yeah, it was an incredible concession on the part of the Obama administration, which partly only agreed to it because, you know, half of the Obama administration liked it and liked that their hand was forced into austerity. Like they would have liked to do that themselves because there are still these kind of Clinton holdovers who it was the Biden committee, if you remember. That was a part of this mix. You had Simpson Bowles and you had the Biden committee, which had Eric Cantor and Joe Biden coming up with all these ways to basically cut Social Security, cut Medicare, Medicaid, cut federal spending. So what they ended up doing is saying, all right, we're just going to cap it. And when you cap it and you have, even if you have, you know, modest inflation of 2%, and you might have been doing a 2% increase in spending and instead you do zero, costs are going up, then you're pulling money out of the economy. You're laying off teachers. You're laying off public sector workers. That's the immediate hit to the economy. But then also that money doesn't circulate in the way that it would otherwise. And I actually think that if they had not done that, if the recovery had moved as it was, the Democrats don't lose the Senate in 2014. Right. And then actually they would have Merrick Garland sitting on the Supreme Court right now.
Wow. Yeah. And so, okay. So that's what we saw during the, sort of that era of Republicans when we were told they were, sane.
Those are the moderates.
Those are the moderates and those are your father's Republican Party, which of course was all, it was all BS. And you know what? We'll harken back to that when we get to the deficit talk in a minute. But so, okay. So when you say, that's what they did in the past, tell us about the discharge petition because that was a weird. I mean, what's going on with that?
I don't think that McCarthy could never have gotten that out of the rules because the entire thrust of the push against McCarthy was the speaker has too much power in general, from DeLay as the hammer up through then Pelosi consolidating it into the speaker's office. They were trying to roll it back. They're trying to, pull some of the power down to the rank and file. The discharge petition allows any member of Congress to basically file a motion to discharge. You file a bill, and then if leadership refuses to put it on the floor, if you come to them with a petition that has 218 signatures on it from members of Congress, then it bypasses the leader and gets a vote on the floor. So it would have been very hard. It's a key piece of kind of the not just minority rights, but rank and file rights in the House. So I don't think McCarthy could have been able to get rid of it. And I don't think they even contemplated getting rid of it. It's been part of the rules, maybe going all the way back to the first, it goes way, way, way back. It's very difficult to do, though. Democrats have to move fast because of the arcane rules around it. They basically need to introduce a bill right as soon as the committees are fully in place, so that they, because it has to wait 7 days after you introduce it before it can get referred to a committee. Then you have to wait some 30 legislative days, and the legislative days can take a long time. Then after you've got the signatures, then it takes another 7 legislative days, and then it must go to the floor, but it only goes to the floor on the second and fourth Monday of the month. And a lot of Mondays they're not actually in. And so what McCarthy could try to do is keep them in. This is how the House rules are just an arcane.
Arcane, right. It's like it's arcane on purpose. Is it designed essentially to make it more
somewhat
difficult?
Because then that could allow the speaker to say, well, we're not in session at this point. But what it would do is it would say, look, all the speaker would have to do is be in session. And Congress is scheduled to be in session several Mondays in May, I think a couple Mondays in June, one Monday in July, something like that. And so all they'd have to do is be in session, and there would be a vote then on the floor. But that's if they get 218. Right now they have they'll have 213 after the Virginia seat gets filled. If Santos, gets booted, and Democrats win that could be 214. Then they would need 4 more votes, 4 more signatures.
Okay. All right. So just to be clear here, the idea is that we're anticipating the debt ceiling coming up. I mean, the Treasury is starting. Man. They're starting to talk about it now in terms of like could be the end of this month. But that's the game that they play. They will then punt it, and then they'll figure it out, and then they'll figure it out again. But there will be a drop dead date, and if it does come over the course of summer, Democrats have to start now because 30 business days in the context of Congress could take 3 months. And they could be doing 10, 15 a month. The Monday thing, where did, like, was there, like, what was,
I think that's just always been in there.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
Okay. And Democrats, I imagine are intending to do so because then they have 4 or 5 months in which to find those other votes that they need to actually pass an increase in the debt limit. And by just scheduling a Monday, McCarthy can sort of like pretend like he wasn't involved in raising the debt ceiling and sort of in many respects disarming some of these people.
Yes, although you would definitely have the Freedom Caucus types demanding that he not come in session. But then you have the and then it becomes about optics. Then you've got a majority of the House of Representatives on record by that point, assuming in this scenario that they want to raise the debt ceiling in a clean way and avoid a crisis. And you'd have McCarthy bowing to the Freedom Caucus, just refusing to bring the House into session and then basically forcing a default like that. Democrats need to start thinking about the best ways that they can shame Republicans around this, and if you shape it that way, like all McCarthy has to do is bring the House into session on the days that he said he would bring it into session, and we don't have a global crisis. Like that's your one job. Like that great picture in the video with him and the gavel. Boom. That's all you got to do. That's it. And then
right.
and then your work is done.
And you could frame this as like they're too lazy to come in on a Monday because they want a long weekend and save the world economy. That, right. I mean, that seems to be sort of like an easy, it doesn't get the fruit doesn't hang a little lower than that. Let's put it that way.
Especially if you've got those four or five Republicans, there'll be a lot of pressure on Republicans not to sign on to that. But, you know, if the stories are true that these moderate, quote unquote, moderate Republicans are frustrated with the Freedom Caucus, like this is the way to do it.
What's
the other way that I saw somebody else pointed out another way to do it that could almost even be easier because of how difficult it is to, you know, navigate this through would be to take the Problem Solvers Caucus, you know, Josh Gottheimer's little crew that claims that they're about bipartisanship. They've got, what, 14 Republicans, 14 Democrats. They could easily depose McCarthy. Like, what, just takes one person, one from the majority, filing a motion to vacate. They could pass it, and then they could put McCarthy right back in. Like, nothing would stop them from doing that. I'd be like, look, we don't actually want to run the House. We don't think we have a governing coalition, but we want to avert a global catastrophe. We have the power to do this, and therefore we're going to do it. And now you can file a motion to vacate, and we're done.
So wait a second. So they take him out.
Right.
I don't understand. They take him out and they depose him and then they put him back in.
Right.
And
so you'd,
in what other happens words, in the interim period?
In the interim period, the new speaker, somebody from the Problem Solvers Caucus, would bring the debt ceiling to the floor.
Well, why don't those debt ceiling people just vote? Oh, I see. Because they need that Monday as well for part of that. Yeah. There's a bunch of different ways to do this, but what was the value? I mean, was this just a question of like Manchin wouldn't refuse to raise the debt ceiling or get rid of it in the lame duck session? I mean, because it didn't seem like Joe Biden pushed very hard on it either, and that seems also ridiculous. Like, do the Democrats really? Is it? Do the Democrats think that they get a political benefit out of these type of things, or is it that there are things that they want to concede to the Republicans? And this is the way to put them in a position where, like, we've been held hostage. We had to cut Social Security a living increase or something.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that they like it when the Republicans are acting totally crazy and, you know, threatening global catastrophes around cutting Social Security. And I think some of them certainly like to go after entitlements. You know, Bruce Reed, top Biden aide. I think he was with the top staffer. He's still the top staffer to Biden and the committee that wanted to cut, you know, Social Security. Biden has been trying to cut Social Security for like 40 years. Like, he has always thought that that was good politics. Whether he still thinks that's good politics or not, given how the world has changed, I don't know. But those instincts probably die hard. So I think, yeah, it might be some of it. What other explanation could you have for allowing this axe? Just handing this axe to people like Matt Gaetz. Here you go. I'm sure this will be fine. Let me just hand you this very sharp axe that you can hang over our neck for the next 2 years.
Yeah, we interviewed Carla Mattei the other day, who was talking about austerity having been, a full-on part of capitalism. Like, it's not a solution to a problem. It's actually sort of like part of the system on some level. And we were talking about this dynamic where you have, you know, left of center economists saying, what is Jay Powell doing? We don't need to raise interest rates. This is inflation that we're experiencing, and we could talk about this a little bit more. Is not a function of excess demand. Why is he disciplining labor? Because the answer could just be like his job is to discipline labor, and it's not that he's making making some type of miscalculation. It's just that you don't understand what the equation he's working on is. And sometimes it feels like that's what the debt ceiling is for Democrats. It is, even if they don't need it now, there is a sense that we should hang on to this because it's an effective tool in the future.
Biden's word that he used to describe getting rid of the debt ceiling in the lame duck is instructive. He called it irresponsible. So, you know, he feels like it is the Democrats' kind of responsibility to live within their means, to tighten their belts. You know, to you know, be good stewards of the debt and the deficit and of spending, not to be tax and not to be irresponsible tax and spend liberals. You know, I think that's where that comes from. It's hard to see it any other way. And if you look at what's the main story that the kind of business press has been freaking out about for the last, you know, couple of years, it's these uppity workers, you know, who on in the professional class, they're refusing to come, you know, they're making a lot of demands and they're refusing to come back into the office. And in the working class, they're demanding higher wages. They're quitting and getting new jobs that pay more, and they're organizing into unions. Like, and this has been the outrage that is, that's expressing itself relentlessly in the business press. And so, yeah, it, austerity is the answer to that problem of theirs.
And you mentioned, you know, Biden's sort of past in this. I think in We Got People, the book that you wrote, I'm not sure if you remember that, you talk about Biden doing an end run around Harry Reid when these issues came up before, and allowing the Republicans to use the leverage from something that was going to sunset anyways, as a way of skirting around and cutting Social Security. Now, the best thing I can say about Biden that I've always said is the guy's a cipher. And if there's a sense that this is a, there is political value or his sense that the politics around this have changed, then it becomes less of an issue. Right. And I would also add, it's also fascinating. I think it's instructive for people. Like, on one hand, you have this push in the administration to disempower workers. And even when he is in an opportunity to help out the train workers, which, you know, it's a small number of people, you know, at the end of the day, but it sends a big statement in terms of like where the administration is in terms of unions. At the other end of the administration, you have the FTC and Lina Khan. The non-compete clause that they're going to ban, it appears, that's going to empower workers tremendously across the board.
Yes, yeah, it sure will, and it'll be interesting which Biden will show up to these negotiations, because among the biggest risks of a Biden presidency are that one, he's a just absolutely terrible negotiator who thinks he's a great negotiator. And his kind of austerian instincts in that anecdote that you talked about, Harry Reid was doing the logical thing, which was, he's like, I'm going to take Mitch McConnell off the cliff with me. There was this fiscal cliff set up, which after midnight on December 31st, like whatever it was, 2010, all of the Bush tax cuts were going to expire, like all of them, boom. And so Reid's like, if I don't do anything and we just ride this car, we're going off this cliff. And then after we go off the cliff, let's talk about cutting some of these taxes. Mm. You want to cut them back? Sure. The middle class tax cuts. Let's bring those back.
Right. Let the Democrats take the credit for middle class tax cuts. Yeah. And the Republicans are completely jammed up in that situation.
And so Mitch McConnell made a call to Biden. And they allowed Biden to come in, and Biden bailed out Mitch McConnell. And after that, Reid cut a worse deal than Reid had already extracted from McConnell. And after that, Reid told the White House, you cannot send this man down to the Senate ever again, like to talk to Republicans. And be, like, if he wants to come and like glad hand, fine. But he can never be involved in these again. And he didn't approve it that time either. It's McConnell just very wisely called his old friend Joe. You know, they'd known each other since the 80s, and he just called him up and said, you would not believe how mean Harry Reid is being to me. And Joe's like, let's talk. Let's come to a deal. And brutal. God.
I remember that period of time. That was horrible. And then they tried to do that again, I think, with a Social Security cost of living adjustment. Mm-hmm. The discharge petition, that's something to see if the Democrats do literally the day after the committee forms, that they start that process.
Yeah, they could start drafting the bill now.
Does anybody have a plan to do that?
Be a short bill. I have talked to Democrats who said they're open to using discharge petition for all manner of different things, but I haven't heard of anybody who's planning to do that. It would have to be, it wouldn't have to be a leadership driven plan. Yeah. Anybody could introduce the bill and then do the motion to discharge. AOC did one around the stock trading.
Yeah. Would Hakeem Jeffries be more open to it than Pelosi was to that? I mean, Pelosi wasn't as open to it because she's literally benefits from the ability to trade. But with this, it's like, is there any indication that he sees that as like a better option?
Well, you're right. You make a. They should just do the stock one again because, like you said, Pelosi undermined it at the end. So they might as well just redo that and force McCarthy to live up to his word. But I don't know. These, like you said, these Democratic leaders, like, do they? How hard do they want to fight this? Like, to me, they should do it now so they preserve the option because you can't come back in May and June. Be like, oh, we should have done that because then it's too late. You don't have the 30 legislative days, et cetera, to make it work. But, right, how, like, do Democrats actually want to go to the wall on this? Like, it's not obvious that they do. But on the other hand, like, what do they expect? They're gonna, like,
I mean, take the Republicans at their word. They're going to do this. So you might as well put a preventative measure in place to ensure, I mean, I don't know why you would not be proactive about this.
I mean, and even if you wanted to pull the plug on the effort later, I mean, you want yourself to have the option, right? You do it now because it's a long process. Right. And if you don't start it now, you don't have the option. Let me ask you this. And maybe it's too early to tell, but, the best thing I can say about Nancy Pelosi is that, when we were entering into an era with, when we were entering an era where you needed a minority leader in the House that, you know, knew the rules, had a iron grip on the caucus to prevent, you know, defections for, like, people, you know, like the problem solvers, like the concern, and, you know, I think the caucus has gotten less conservative. I think that's also the case with the Senate over the past, you know, 20 years. And so you always have these people who are like, well, I'm willing to make a deal with the Republicans. Nancy Pelosi was good at, like, in my estimation, having control over her caucus. She had been in there for 10, 15 years by the time that, you know, Trump was elected. And that was important. This is a different situation where you don't need that strong and that authoritarian, really, frankly, for lack of a better word, iron grip on the caucus, because the White House is also a veto point and the Senate is a veto point for the worst that the Republicans can offer. Is there a different feel amongst the Democratic caucus where, you know, maybe the Progressive caucus has grown and it's gotten in some parts of it have gotten stronger than it was even last year, but never mind 5 years ago. I mean, is there a sense that there are people who are freelancing a little bit more or planning to do stuff regardless of what Hakeem Jeffries says? I mean, he's only in there for, you know, been in there for a short period of time. He doesn't have that much leadership experience. He sort of moved up one when Crowley took early retirement, took the buyout without getting the benefits. And what's your sense of that? Is there a sense of, like, okay, now she's gone and we got a little bit more room to maneuver?
I don't think it's clear yet. And, you know, we should know in the next, you know, month or so if any of these either freshmen or any of the current, like, progressives start doing anything creative. We'll see. The problem for Democrats in the minority, you know, progressive Democrats in the minority, is that they're going to end up just opposing almost everything that House Republicans do, but so will Hakeem Jeffries.
Right.
And so it becomes hard to distinguish yourself. Like, well, I'm against that. You're against that. I'm against that. It's like Democrats in the Bush era. Like, everybody's against Bush. And so it flattens the distinctions among individual Democrats. We'll see if any of them will do anything interesting. Like, we had Ro Khanna on Counterpoints on Wednesday, and I asked him if he would join the church committee. And he, the so-called, you know,
we not call
community.
It the church committee.
Sorry.
It's a weaponized federal government committee. And it's like, this is, talk about stolen valor. Mm. I mean, give me a break.
We need to Frank Luntz this. We need our own reframing. Well,
I mean, but I mean, and I, you know, like Ilhan Omar was, you know, talking about like, this is a good opportunity. I think it is a good opportunity, but to call it the church committee, right. Let's be honest. These guys are not interested in finding, you know, sort of like abuses of power amongst the national security state on your average person or on
or
dissenters.
American foreign policy.
No, they're looking right, at like who contacted Twitter.
Right. So if you get somebody like Rokhana or Ilhan Omar on the committee who actually wants to
expand.
Say, hey, what's on page two of that finding right. that you've got there? That could be fun. But then Khanna's answer was basically like, I'd have to have a ton of assurances that it's not going to be a partisan operation, but which of course it's going to be very difficult to get those assurances since that they won't really be true. So a lot of Democrats are going to have a hard time kind of getting to the place where they would even participate in it. Cause they don't want to legitimize it. But otherwise there's not a ton of available, you know, availability when it comes to like legislative room for maneuvering. Antitrust could be one, for sure. Because you have a decent number of Republicans who are into that. Although the Republican Party leadership is not. So you'd have to, that would be another discharge petition situation basically, or a situation where you just try to embarrass House Republicans by refusing, you know, they're refusing to take up this bill, whatever. But it's so hard to break through with that stuff. Like nobody cares.
About antitrust.
Or just about like what the House won't do. It's hard enough to get people to care about what the House is doing. But to try to get them to care about what it's not doing is that much harder. Listeners and viewers accepted, of course.
Yes, that's true. Actually, we talked about antitrust just on Wednesday. We had someone from the American Liberties. What is it? The
American something Economic Liberties Project or something.
Yes. Yeah, they used to be open market people.
Yeah, that was so much easier. I don't know what happened.
So much easier. Yeah. Folks, I got to apologize again. The construction that is completely surrounding me, I know is.
sure, that's what it is.
All right. Well, let's just talk. We mentioned the deficit in inflation a little bit in the course of things. Inflation has cooled significantly. We still, if you go from 2021 to 2022, it ramped up by 7%. I don't know that we ever had deflation because of COVID, but those price hikes are real to a certain extent. But, you know, eggs cost like, I mean, it's not, I mean, in New York City, you can find eggs for $9 a dozen. Mm-hmm. But just even across the country, they have expanded, they've gotten more expensive. But that's because we killed billions of chickens because of the avian flu. And in a year or two, stocks will be back and that'll be down. I saw a report saying, you know, inflation cools again this month, but only because of gas and, because of energy. And, I can't remember what to say, but like the two biggest things that have been driving it in the first place. So we have Powell that may slow a little bit. But then the Democrats come out and like are trumpeting like the deficit's cut in half, which is just, it's bizarre. It's almost like Eric Adams like talking about crime in New York City, because no one cared about the deficit for the past year. I don't know, 6 years really, during Trump and through COVID. What's the value of bringing it up in that instance?
It's just they've internalized the Republican criticisms of them over the decades, and they just can't get over themselves. Like they're just not as savvy as Republicans when it comes to, you know, their own self-confidence. Like Democrats can criticize Republicans constantly about whatever it is. It doesn't seem to bother them. Call them warmongers, call them whatever. Like they don't run around saying, ha, see, you know, we didn't bomb this country. How do you like that? See, we're not warmongers. They just do their thing. But yeah, Democrats have just absorbed this criticism that they are the ones that are running up the deficit. And, you know, they went, you know, and so they're so excited that you know, the deficit is coming down, which, like you said, nobody cares about. People care about what things cost, what they're making, how easy it is to get easier, hard it is to get a job. Like, that's what people care about. If the deficit is high and it's hard for them to get a job and wages are down and inflation is up and people are talking about the deficit all the time, then people are going to tell pollsters that they care about the deficit because they'll think of it as a proxy for all their other economic problems.
Right.
But if there aren't those other economic problems and the press isn't talking about deficit, nobody's going to say boo about it. So you're right. It's like, it's just them. They just can't get over themselves. Like, forget about the deficit. Nobody cares. Like, what people care about is like the inflation number is good. Like, you know, CPI was down 0.1% over the month. You know, it looks like we peaked in June and have been steadily coming down, since then.
And we're like still adding more jobs
and adding jobs
than at like any time on a consistent month to month basis than I can remember. And I've been doing this for 18 years. And like, no. You know, I, you know, the idea that we're adding 230,000 jobs a month, and we're now, I think, technically at the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. And we're watching all these labor actions. The nurses won their strike in New York City after 3 days. These labor actions are completely tied into the notion of how empowered workers feel, and that is a function of those numbers and the sense that people can find another job and this and that. And so we're in good shape, and it's almost like the administration can't help but say, like, but there's this looming problem out there that we want you to know that we've, like, you know, we've been able to sort of bail, but the ship is sinking. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It just doesn't make any sense. I wonder, you know, this is a good opportunity maybe to segue into Katie Porter announcing that she's going to run in California to get rid of one of our, you know, sort of, I don't know what could be more emblematic than the problems that we have with Democratic leadership than Dianne Feinstein. But like, do we just need a completely new generation of Democrats to come in? We're going to still have some problems where people are ideologically, but just in terms of like shooting themselves in the foot.
Right. Get the people who can't forget, like who can't forget Reagan out of there. Like it's over.
Or
like,
McGovern, you know, for that matter.
McGovern. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Still scarred by McGovern for sure. I think she, if she can get out of her own way, I think, like, managerially speaking, like the big knock on her has been
Katie Porter.
Is kind of the churn in her Hill staff.
I saw her being asked about that on Pod Save America, and I'll be honest, the answer was a tad concerning.
What'd she say?
It just was like a bit.
Get out of the kitchen.
It was a bit defensive in tone, and I mean, look, the staffer was supposedly anonymous, but she started calling the staffer she, so clearly there's an understanding of who this person is, and it was awkward, but I mean, at the same time, it's like, how do you weigh these things, and do you let it get in the way of somebody who would have a much more progressive bend being in Congress?
To me, it's not something that as a voter, you really even need to weigh. You should prefer that people are good managers rather than bad managers. People prefer that they treat workers well rather than they don't. But trying to divine it from the outside is kind of useless. You'll figure it out. Like if her campaign implodes because of it, and she misses, you know, huge opportunities, et cetera, then you don't have to think about it. Like it worked itself out. If she runs a great, smooth campaign, then she figured it out. Like, and candidates, I think, like her should find some more humility around the managerial side and just hire a campaign manager. Be like, look, I recognize that I have a lot of strengths. This isn't one of them. You just do this. Like, you know, hire somebody who's really good at it. Just have them do it, and then just focus on what you're good at, which is, you know, meeting with voters, you know, coming up with, you know, creative policies that capture people's imaginations, you know, finding ways to investigate the villains in a and you know, creating and exposing the villains, like do all of that. Let the other people handle the management. So we'll see if, it'll work itself out. Like it's not something we even need to, observe too much. We'll just see it happen.
What do you think of Barbara Lee's candidacy?
That's an interesting one. And maybe like in some ways she's setting herself up to be appointed if Feinstein decides not to finish up her term or something.
Yeah. She,
Barbara Lee's done a great job of, she's part of the Democratic Party establishment. Like she's very close to Nancy Pelosi. She's in, she's basically in the kind of leadership circle. She's been a loyal Democrat, but she represents, the Bay Area, Oakland, and, has taken some courageous votes, and she's been prescient about a few things, and she's done a good job of kind of leaning into that, and has kind of created a perception among a kind of a national audience that she's practically a squad member, despite having, basically being in the Democratic Party leadership circles. So she's really an interesting case. And I think the fact that she was like literally active with the Black Panthers as a young radical, probably, plays into that. Like that's, people around the country, I'm sure, like, whoa, that's pretty cool. Has somebody with a Black Panther in Congress?
Think it's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
In the Senate.
Exactly cool. Yes.
But it would be, it would be much cooler if that had taken place in the 90s and not in the 60s. And I mean, that's the problem. She's 76 years old, right? Is 76?
76.
I would love her.
Upon being sworn in. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she would be her first term at the end of her first term. She'd be 84. It would be great if she got appointed. Let's put it that way. Right. And we had a senator who all of a sudden was like, 10 years younger, 15 years younger than Dianne Feinstein.
And aware of what's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. And conscious. Is there anybody in the Democratic Party who can look at this race and come in and say, because right now it feels like this Senate race, assuming Dianne Feinstein either doesn't serve out her term or someone tells her it's time to resign, is literally going to expend, I think, a multiple of a figure that would solve homelessness in California. I don't even think that's hyperbole. I mean, I think that like literally the dollar figure that's going to be expended in a race that's going to ultimately be about two Democrats in the general election. There's going to be a primary and then there's going to be a general and it's going to be Democrats only involved in all of this. It just seems like a horrible, horrible waste, but there's really no way to avoid that, is there?
I can't think of one. And that sets up Adam Schiff really nicely. Like, if you go into the FEC and start checking out like who the top Democratic fundraisers have been over the last 5 years or so, I'm always shocked. Like, oh, Adam Schiff, he raised something like $100 million last, like some absolutely ungodly amount of money. Now he spends a lot of that back on mostly Facebook. Doing digital marketing. So he's one of those guys, if he raises $100 million, he spends $80 million
to raise that.
Okay. So I guess all that money's staying in California, right there in Silicon Valley. So that's nice for California's economy, just circulating that money around. But because of his, constant kind of competition with Donald Trump, he became this kind of star figure among, resistance, fueled Democrats who would just open up their wallets to his email every time it landed in their inbox. Now, Katie Porter has that too, like not at Schiff's level because of Schiff's contest with Trump, but because Katie Porter is, slicing up so many different villains, people have been willing to send enormous amounts of money to her as well. And so, yes, so not only are you going to see like rich Californian Democrats spending enormous amounts of money on this campaign, you're going to see regular people from around the country, pouring $25 at a chunk, into this California race,
This feels like it could be a heightened version of what we saw in New York 10 with Dan Goldman, who also had like public cachet for being anti-Trump, and two progressives on the ballot that ended up splitting votes, and that where you essentially could and handed it to him. I mean, I would love if either Barbara Lee or Katie Porter ran. I'm not sure I'm. And I know they have a jungle primary process, but it's still, you can build momentum being that kind of fundraising juggernaut as Adam Schiff going into the jungle or the general against either Porter or Lee.
It also, if there's only one Republican who, you know, ends up at like 30% or something, then you could potentially have, you know, a Republican make it into the top two. If like, you know, Schiff at 32, Republican at 30, you know, Porter at 25, Lee at 20, you know, Feinstein at 5 or whatever, maybe Feinstein at 30, you know, it's hard to know how that's going to shake out. But the good news for Democrats is that it is the top two. And if in New York 10 there was a top two situation, you would have had Goldman
lose to
in the general. What would it have been? Was it Yulin second place?
And Yonder Jones.
I think he came in third or fourth. I think it was I can't remember her name.
I think Yulin knew it. Yeah. I think Yulin know what
she Yulin got.
Was Yulin. Yeah.
So then it would have been the two of them.
Carlina Rivera. But anyway, if Mondaire had chosen just not to run, it seems pretty obvious that, you know, he would have that Yulin likely would have beaten Dan Goldman. We don't know, but
maybe Goldman spends more money against her at that point. But yeah, but you're right. But so at least there's that top two situation.
Right.
And then if it's Porter versus a Republican or whatever in the general, at least that would save $1 billion because she would still need to spend, but not as much. Like a Democrat's not going to lose in 2024 to a Republican in the general in California.
Right. All right. Well, let me ask you this, Ryan, as a final question. I know you have these big staff meetings at The Intercept, and you hand out assignments. What should we be looking for over the next couple of weeks?
Oh man, good question. I would say over in the House, like watching these, you know, committee assignments fill up, and you know, watching you know, where the various like Freedom Caucus folks end up. I think that's going to be fun. I think antitrust, like you were talking about, is actually alive. Like that's interesting stuff. I think there's a real live fight underway around Medicare Advantage. Like that hasn't gone away. I know you guys covered that before. There's this, you know, there's real risk that the Biden administration is just going to continue this, basically this privatization effort of Medicare. And so like that's something that's a live fight, but the debt ceiling, like they've got to start moving on it now.
Right. That discharge.
And they've got to start kind of normalizing the like crazy ideas around it, like mint the coin or just ignore the debt ceiling or, you know, various ways to just say, you know what, we're not doing this again.
I think it's been 10 years since I had somebody on about the platinum coin, but I guess 20, it's time to get back on that again. Yeah. Ryan Grimm, Bureau Chief, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept and co-host of Counterpoints on Wednesday.
That's right.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right, folks. Emma's going to take you into the fun half now, and I'm going to just sit and listen to the
pounding.
Yeah. Dulcet sounds of the pounding that is taking place, and see if Myla needs some soup or something like that that I can leave by her door and then run away. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free half free of commercials, but you also get the fun half, ladies and gentlemen, which is coming right up. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. On Monday, we're going to do our annual compilation of Martin Luther King clips of some of his speeches, of some of how his an interview that he did. I think it was his first NBC interview or like a debate show. It's fascinating just to see how he was perceived at that time. And then I know it includes an announcement of his death by, I think it was Walter Cronkite, and a clip of Nina Simone singing just days after his assassination. Wow. Emma will do the intro for that, because we had to record that. So don't forget to record that, guys, at the end of the show today.
Okay.
And speaking of Emma, and don't forget, did I say justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate? Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We'll be back live on Tuesday. Emma, ESVN.
Yeah. Big time episode yesterday. You guys should check it out. We gave a preview for the upcoming wild card weekend. I mean, there's nothing like the NFL playoffs, truly. It's very exciting. And the Giants are in it, and they're playing Matt's Minnesota Vikings. We haven't really gotten into that at all.
Didn't that guy Travis, what's that guy's name? Clay Travis? Is that a guy's name?
Yeah, that's him.
He just,
he's like a right wing talk.
Yeah, he just said that the left doesn't like football. I saw on Twitter. And I saw
Matt Walsh said that too, and that the women don't know anything about football is what he said.
It's funny that they say that.
I tweeted at him, and he hasn't responded. It has over like 6,000 likes, so I know.
Oh my God. I would love to. I didn't see that. I would love to. You have a conversation with Matt Walsh about football.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's funny because it's contradictory. Like half of these guys are like, yeah, this sport is too woke now. I can't watch it anymore. And then they're like, actually, it's the left that hates this sport.
Right. And it's only for men. Like, women can't understand it. But we gave our preview for the wild card weekend, picked against the spread and over unders, which we're going to expand to do that in the playoffs because we have fewer games, fewer things to select from. We also did a good vibes and bad vibes awards for the teams that did not make the playoffs, which teams are, you know, circling the drain and which ones are on the up and up. And I think we also talked about Lamar Jackson's kind of touchy situation with the Baltimore Ravens. And I don't think he'll be there next year, which is kind of sad. So youtube.com/ESPN show.
Matt, what's happening on in the Matt Leck Media Enterprise?
Yes, January 2nd. This is Revolution Left Reckoning. Give Them an Argument. Live in Manhattan, New York City at the Cutting Room. Get your tickets, folks, at Eventbrite. And Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland also going to be there. Bhaskar Sankara, it's going to be a real brain trust. So get your tickets now, folks.
Oh, I should also add, I think I am doing Get Your Argument on. I think I'm
Give Them an Argument on
Give Them
an
Argument on Monday. On Monday, it turns out. I thought it was Tuesday because he originally told me Tuesday, and now it's Monday. So I think it's going to be Monday night. So tune in. I think 8 p.m. is usually when he does it, right?
That sounds right, yep.
I mean, 8 p.m.
Tuesday didn't sound right because that's when we do it, so.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he told me the 17th, and then it turns out that it's the 16th, so that's on him, but I'll be there on Monday night. Mm. He did, and wow. I don't.
You never do that.
Well, and not only do I not do it, I have no tolerance for it. So, all right, 646-257-3920. Emma will be taking your phone calls in the fun half of the program. You know, we didn't book anybody because I thought, you know, you were back and we would give us an opportunity to goof around. But
I know.
And I should say, people probably can't hear the pounding that's going on here in the way that we can hear it because we're filtering it as it goes out through the board to the audience. But It is... I cannot tell you how distracting it is and how loud it is on this end.
Our filter's doing a good job, but yeah, I'm sorry. It's like with this, and we were just saying how it's like they're building a building near our office as well. So this is going to be the construction.
We're going to be testing this new noise reduction, these new noise reduction algorithms.
This will be known as the construction era of the program. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. Also, you can IM the show through our now new app on both Android and iOS platforms. It's an amazing app. You should check it out, and it's totally free. If you're a member, you can IM the show. And if you're a member, you can search our deep archives. 12 years. We just hit 13. We had 3,000 shows the other day and didn't even notice it.
Wow.
We don't like the marketing department of this enterprise. They are really 3,000.
They don't exist. Yeah.
Like that's probably the biggest milestone. Like we're going to hit 4,000, maybe 6,000. I think it's going to be tricky, but I mean, it's possible, but
you just skipped right over 5,000.
Yeah, I know, but there's
that's
a symmetry.
That's a big milestone. I mean, that's the one I think we pay attention to.
3,000 is a big one.
Okay.
Is there another show out there, do you think, that is 3,000 episodes?
Well, I mean, who does daily stuff?
Yeah.
But they might not number it the way we do, but they've probably done the volume.
Would have. All right. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Denner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.